Welcome. This is the first in a series of lectures for Introduction to Visual Basic for Central Maine Community College. The course number is CPT 130. This semester, we're using Visual Basic 2012 How to Program 6th Edition with Paul Dytel. These slides actually come from the author. Hopefully, I'll fill in some of the blanks that are on the slides. So we have some quotes here from the author. The chief merit of language is clearness from Galen. Our life is frittered away with detail. Simplify, simplify, Henry David Thoreau. And man is still the most extraordinary computer of all, John F. Kennedy. So that's just to kind of bridge the gap here and give us something to think about before we really get into things. So in chapter one, we're really going to stray away from learning the Visual Basic programming language. Chapter one is designed basically to introduce you to computers and the reason why we need programming languages. So we're going to not really dive into Visual Basic until the next chapter. There's some walkthroughs at the end that I'll have you go through, some opening some programs and such. But really, we're not going to dive into any language components in this chapter. So the objectives for this chapter are to learn some basic hardware and software data concepts, different types of programming languages. Obviously, Visual Basic is not the only one out there. Some history of it. It talks about what Windows Azure is. We're gonna stray away from most of that topic, just because we don't have time to cover it in detail, and it really isn't designed for this kind of class. The basics of object technology. Some history of the internet and the World Wide Web, parts of the .NET framework, and how it all kind of blends together. And then again, at the end of the chapter, they have you go through a walkthrough. I'm not going to go through that walkthrough in this lecture, but you're obviously welcome to do it on your own time. And definitely, I suggest if you're not familiar with the programming languages, definitely follow it step by step so you can see what's going on. So 1.1 talks about how data is really processed. So data really is the key of our computer programs. Our computer programs is going to use sequence of instructions to actually process data, interpret information, and give us kind of a result. So we're going to enter some information. We're going to have a computer program that's going to run on that information, and then it's going to kick out some sort of result for us. Obviously, the people who write those computer programs are called computer programmers. So in this class, you're taking the role of a computer programmer. You're going to write the software that's going to run the application, that's going to do the step-by-step methodologies to get a result that we're looking for. So one of the buzzwords in computer programming that a lot of people talk about is what's called object-oriented programming. So object-oriented programming has been around for a while. It's not a new idea, but it kind of strays away from that mentality of our COBOL and our Fortran languages, where it was a step-by-step instruction and treats data as an object. So it's going to be something that we're going to manipulate in memory. We're going to have some methods and functions to sort of change and manipulate what we're working with. It's not really something that you need to worry about right now, just something to keep in the back of your mind. Hopefully, it will clear up as we go throughout the course what object-oriented programming is. Just be aware that Visual Basic is an object-oriented programming language. So the things that we're going to do are in that methodology, whether or not you realize it. So we're going to create some objects, software objects, that are going to abstract real-world things. So when we talk about rolling a dice, we're going to have an object called a die, and we're going to roll it. So we know conceptually what a dice is. We know that when you roll a die, a face comes up, and you'll have a number. So that's what it's talking about, really, in object-oriented technology. We're going to treat our software designs as objects. And again, Visual Basic is designed to build for different environments, desktops, tablets, cloud, mobile devices like smartphones. Visual Basic really is a Windows-oriented program. Anything that can run the .NET framework can run Visual Basic programs, but really it's designed for a Windows environment. Section 1.2 again talks about some hardware. So again, we're all familiar with hardware, or should be all familiar with hardware at this point. You know, our CPUs, our keyboards, mouse, screens, DVD drives, printers, anything that's physically there is considered hardware. And early in computer hardware, Gordon Moore, who was the co-founder of Intel. Intel is, of course, one of the leading manufacturers of computer processors today. They make everything for the Mac, MacBooks. They make everything for Windows PCs. So you're either dealing with usually Intel or AMD. So Intel is a huge piece. But early in the days of computer hardware, Gordon Moore noticed there was this pattern going on of things that every 2 years, the capacities of computer hardware doubled as cheaply as they could make them. Really, in his experience, they were doubling the amount of processors that they could fit onto a single core. So that was giving increased capacity for computer performance. So computers were doubling their speed, but not doubling their price. Obviously, we can spend as much money as we want to increase our hardware performance, but really we're going to be spending a lot of money. Where he was noticing every 2 years, it was kind of doubling performance. And as they saw that, and as they realized that, they kind of take that, what's called Moore's Law, and they apply it to things, rightfully or wrongfully so. That's for you to decide. But they did notice some patterns. So the amount of memory that computers have for running programming and processing data, again, have doubled every 2 years. So again, four, 12 years ago, you know, it wasn't uncommon for us to have, you know, 1 or 2 gigs of RAM, and that be more than we ever thought we would need. Nowadays, we're running something like 32 or 64 gigabytes of RAM, and that seems to be what computers expect nowadays. From a programmer's perspective, early in the days of computer programming, memory was an asset. And we needed to be very careful how we accessed that memory and how we stored that memory. Nowadays, programmers can be more lazy, and operating systems take up a lot more memory. You know, certainly in order to install Windows 8 or Windows 10, you need at least 80 gigs of hard drive space in order to store that. And a lot of that is just bulk. You can run certain versions of Linux from a thumb drive. So it goes to show you how much overhead there are in Windows. So again, extending that Moore's Law, we saw it also extends to secondary storage, like hard disk storage, how much programs need of space to store. Again, older programs took a lot less space. We didn't have it. Now terabytes are pretty common. We're getting up there to petabytes. You'll see storage is not at a premium anymore. Processor speeds, again, are increasing. We've actually gone away from the single core idea. So early in computer programming, it was one central processing unit, and we were increasing the speed of that single central processing unit. Nowadays, we're putting together multiple cores onto our CPU. So the cores are actually physical processing units, and we're actually spreading the work between them. So we'll have 4 cores or 8 cores on a processor, and those are actually 8 single CPUs that are working in tandem with each other to share that information. We've noticed growth in other fields as well, so bandwidth, they've kind of extended it to anything in computers that they can sort of apply this law to. They've kind of done that, and sometimes it's a kind of a stretch, and it's really not a law, it's more of an observation. So another important concept in computer programming is data hierarchy. So again, there's the simplest form of the data that we store in our computers, and then it goes up. So the way that we think about things. We don't think about things in terms of bits and bytes, and characters. We think of them as files and as storage. But if you think of data hierarchy kind of as that folder structure where you double click on something and it brings you closer into your data, it's a good way to think about it. So again, at the bottom we have our bits. Our bits go up to bytes. Our bytes go to characters. Characters usually go to a field. Fields go to a record, and a record may go to a file. So again, things are ordered. We have our base units. Generally, we don't deal with our base units, but it's good to be aware that they're there. So again, at the bottom we have our bits. It's the smallest form of data that it can assume, and it has a value of either 0 or 1. Bit is short for binary digit. Again, binary meaning it has two values, 0 or 1. And again, it's how the computer functions at the simplest level. So it's aware of those binary levels, zeros and ones. We don't usually ever interact with that or see that, but you'll see some numbers in computers as we move along, represented as binary digits, and it's good to be aware that they're there. The next stack up is really bytes. They don't really talk about bytes here because bytes, again, are just a representation of numbers, but they move on to what's called characters. Our ANSI or Unicode character set forms up all of these letters. So we're talking the uppercase letters, the lowercase letters, decimal digits 0 through 9. We're also talking our special characters like our number sign or at sign, etc. And they're basically all stored in there representing a set, and we can use those to write out. So each one of those will have an ANSI or ASCII value, which can be manipulated. One thing that's important to note, and we'll come back and talk about it later, is that a capital A and a lowercase a are two explicitly different characters, so they have different values. So intrinsically, as we learn our alphabet, we think of A as a letter, and it can be capital letter or lowercase letter, but numerically it's stored differently in the computer. One's going to have a value, and the other one's going to have a different value. And when we go to compare capital A to lowercase a, you'll see that there's a difference between the two. Visual Basic supports multiple different character sets, 16-bit Unicode characters, 2-byte characters. Appendix D has more information again on the ASCII or ANSI character set, which is actually a subset of the Unicode character sets to represent the English language. So just as characters are composed of bits, fields are composed of composed rather of characters or bytes. A field is going to be a group of characters or bytes that conveys meaning. A field consists of uppercase and lowercase characters, usually representing a person's name or some sort of information there. Several fields composed of a record. So in a payroll system, you're going to have an employee, which may have an identification number, a name, an address, an hourly rate. And all of those separate informations are going to be stored as a field, and all of the fields together come as a record. So a record is a group of related fields. And then we'll have our file, and our file is going to contain a group of records. So again, it's higher order. A file contains records. Records contain fields. Fields contain characters. Characters contain bytes. So again, it's all related to each other. So on top of our files, we have a database. A database brings multiple files together. It's going to have tables that includes records and fields, and then we can search, sort, and manipulate that data. We have, of course, here SQL that's devoted entirely to databases. If you take our Advanced Visual Basic course, we talk about databases and we manipulate databases as well. So just be aware of that. There's another hot keyword in computer technology, and that's big data. Big data just means a lot of data that is kind of floating around there. How you store your customers' information, how you access your customers' information. If you look up the word big data, You'll have multiple different definitions, multiple different meanings, and really nobody knows what big data is. It's just a lot of information out there. So just be aware of that as well. So in terms of computer storage, we have our data sets. So our smallest level again is our bits. Our bits go into bytes. 1 kilobyte is 1024 bytes, 10 to the third. 1 megabyte, again, 1024 kilobytes. So you'll notice each step goes up by 1024. So just be aware of that if you're doing calculations. So when they talk about megabytes versus megabits, that's the factor coming in. So bytes is up by a factor of 1024, and bits is usually 1,000. So just be aware of that as well. So Section 1.4 begins us into what computer organization. So computers can be divided into various logical units or sections. So we have an input unit, which is going to receive information that can be done by a DVD drive, a USB flash drive, or a keyboard or mouse. Can also be a webcam. Just that it's going to take data into the system somehow and feed it in. We have some output units, which is going to output the information. It can be a video, it can be display, it can be a printer. Somehow it's going to spit that information out. We have a memory unit, which is going to store our information. And again, there's a couple of different types of memory. There's long-term memory, or there's volatile memory, which is lost actually when you turn the computer off. So our volatile memory is like our RAM, which is just going to store the information as we're using it, and then when we turn it off, it's going to go away. We have an ALU or arithmetic logic unit that's going to do all of our calculations for us. Generally, it's considered a part of the CPU, so you don't go and say, "Hey, I want the newest ALU." No, you say, "I want the newest CPU," because the CPU contains the arithmetic logic unit that's going to do the calculations for us. The CPU, again, is going to be the administrative supervising engine. Again, I mentioned that when you have multiple processors in the system, it has to divide up the workload between the different cores in that processor. So the CPU is responsible for doing what's called time division multiplexing. It's going to take those instructions in, it's going to divide up which instructions need to be done at which time, and actually operate on the instructions and go through the instruction set in the logical order that they're presented. So when you double click on something, it's going to process that double click as well as all of the operations that are going on in the background. So it has to keep track of what's going on in the system at all times, whether it be front, what you're looking at, or some background process. So again, a multi-core processor, a dual-core processor has two, quad-core has four, and again, the CPU will take care of that most of the time. You don't have to worry about the multiple cores in a system. So a computer system can also have a secondary storage unit, long term, generally a hard drive, which holds information. Can also be a DVD drive. Some computer systems are connected to NAS or network attached storage. Others are connected to SAN or a storage area network. Again, not anything that you need to worry about directly. Just realize that information that's stored in a secondary storage unit is going to be long term. It's not going to go away when you turn off the computer. It'll be there when you come back. So Section 1.5 talks about machine languages, assembly languages, and high-level languages. So really, we talked about the base level unit being bits and bytes, binary digits. And really, the step up from that is machine level language. That's what computers understand. So, in the early days of computer programming, computer programmers needed to learn this machine level language in order to manipulate the instructions in the computer. So, there's certain registers in the computer that actually store the data that computer programmers are working with. And the machine level languages references those registers by their memory address. And it's not something that's really human readable. If you're into machine level languages and you learn machine level languages, you can do some amazing things very quickly. You have direct access to a lot of information. So a lot of low level programming done in machine level languages is really fast. The next level up is the assembly level languages. Again, assembly level languages is a little more human readable and allows computer programmers to write code faster than they did in machine level language. Assembly actually has to convert to machine level language in order for those machines to understand it. But again, assembly level language still is difficult for humans to read, write, and understand in. So in order to make programming easier, they developed a high level language. So high level languages like C, C++, Visual Basic, Pascal, Python, Perl, those are high level languages that are very human readable. They're something that you can look at and understand intuitively what's going on very quickly. But in order to get it back to the computer, we need a device called a compiler. So the compiler is going to take that high level language and convert it back into machine level language. Now, different programming languages do this differently. So, in terms of Microsoft Visual Basic, our compiler is going to take our Visual Basic code, it's going to compile it, and then it's going to run in the machine level language that we compiled it on. So, if we're on an Intel computer and we compile our Visual Basic language, then it's only going to work on an Intel computer. If we go to an AMD computer and we try to run the program, it's not going to work because it's not compiled for the machine that it was designed for. Other programming languages get around this. So Java is considered a write once, run anywhere language. So Java's compilers compile it to a Java binary. The Java binary is then run on a Java virtual machine designed to change it to its machine level language. So each machine is going to have a Java runtime that's going to take that Java binary and convert it to its machine level language. So it's never compiled by the compiler into a machine level language when it's created. It's only converted to that Java binary and then run on each machine individually. Again, that kind of diverges a little bit from what we're talking about here with Visual Basic, but be aware that that exists and that's how that's done. So again, we come back in section 1.6 to talk about this object terminology. So in terms of object-oriented programming, we talk about objects as classes. So when we first start to create our Visual Basic program, we're creating a Visual Basic class. And our class allows us to actually create it so that we may be able to reuse that object in the future. And that's what's called modular design. So we're creating something that's self-contained, that has its own information, and that's also portable into our other programs. So when we first start learning about the objects in Visual Basic, we're going to start talking about something like strings. And strings are objects that exist. And there's a string class that's written into Visual Basic. So we won't have to write the operators in order to do operations on strings. We're just going to be able to use the built-in methods, the built-in classes on that string component in order to get it to work. Again, it's a little high level now. It's hard to really grasp what an object is until you get into start using it and then work out the differences between them. So if we start out with an analogy and we talk about a car as an object, you drive a car and you can make it go faster by stepping on the gas pedal. You can stop a car by stepping on the brake. So somebody has to design the car, so the car has a certain shape to it. It's going to have some properties, like it's going to have a color, it's going to have a model, it's going to have a make. And even though each car is different, the idea of stepping on a pedal, we know, increases the speed or stops the car. So it's going to hide the mechanism of how that car does it. You don't need to understand how the engine works in order to be able to step on a gas pedal and make it go faster, or step on a brake pedal and make it stop. So really, that's the idea of object-oriented technology, the encapsulation of information, the hiding of the methods and mechanisms of how everything works, and making it high level so anybody can understand it. So again, people with little or no knowledge of how things work can still use it, still manipulate it, still work it, and get it to do the things they want it to do. So in Visual Basics, we're going to talk about methods and classes. Performing a task requires a method. Methods are written inside of classes, and that the class is going to hide the statement from the user. So that they don't really understand what's going on in the background, and they don't need to. So we create classes that house methods. Again, this goes back to our data hierarchy. And then we make an object from a class. So that's called instantiation. We're creating an instance of an object that's going to refer to its class. So again, as we move along, we're going to talk about things. We're going to talk about strings, and you're going to create an instance of a string, and then you're going to be able to use anything that's defined in the class of string on that instance of that object. Again, it's a little high level, hard to understand really what's going on, but once we get into it, hopefully it'll make more sense to you. So again, the important part of object-oriented technology is going to be reuse. You're going to be able to reuse those classes in your other programs without having to redesign and reintegrate things. So each class is going to work separately from one another. Anything that you need to do within the class is going to be accessed via a method so that you're not exchanging data from one class to another. And having to keep track of how everything is implemented within the class. You don't need to know what I've chosen for variable names within my class. You just need to know what methods I have available for you to be able to access the data that's stored in that class. So messages and method calls. So again, when you send messages to an object, you have what's called a method call. So it's going to actually go into my class to perform a specific task. Within each class, you're going to have attributes and instance variables. Again, the instance variables are going to be created when you instantiate or create an instance of that class. And it's also going to create the attributes. Again, attributes are going to be something that describes that class. So if we go back to our example of the car, how many doors do we have in the car? How much gasoline can it hold in its tank? Miles driven, things like that. And each instance of a car is going to have its own attributes. So if I have one car that's blue and one car that's green, they're not going to share their total miles driven because they're going to be two separate instances of cars. So again, when you create an instance, you're creating basically a duplication of everything that's in that class. Those attributes are going to be carried along with it as long as it's part of the program. So as long as you've created that instance is going to last as long as your program runs. And again, they're called instance variables because we've created an instance of that object and it's going to use those variables. So I mentioned before this idea of encapsulation. So the idea of an encapsulation is actually to take that data, to take all of that information, keep it together and hide it away from the user. So the user can access directly what color car is stored within my instance of the car. They have to use a method to actually get that color. And again, information is hiding. Is crucial to good software engineering. If all of those instance variables are out there and you're writing a banking program, somebody can go in and adjust their bank account balance directly. And obviously, that's not something that we want to let them do. Bad things would probably come from that. Along with object-oriented technology comes this idea of inheritance. So you can create subclasses of classes that inherits the characteristics of their parent class. So again, if we create a new class called Convertible, Convertible is part of our automobile class because all convertibles are automobiles, but not automobiles are all convertibles. Hopefully that makes sense there. So again, it's just a subset of a larger set that's going to have all of the same properties and attributes as its parent set. Then we talk about object-oriented analysis and designs. So again, when you're creating your programs, you want to think about what you're trying to do and how you're going to do it. The more time that you spend prepping for your program, the less time that you'll actually spend writing code. I know from experience, a lot of my students like to dive in and start writing code immediately. That usually gets them into trouble. I definitely recommend you spend a lot of time thinking about what you're trying to do, how you're trying to solve the problem before you solve it. If you can solve it by hand, then you can tell a computer how to solve it. If you can't figure out how to solve it by hand, it's going to be almost impossible for you to tell the computer how to solve that problem. Certainly, if you're solving a math problem, something like 10 times 10, you can do that in your head. 10 times 10 is 100. So if you're telling a computer how to do 10 times 10, it's a lot easier if you know how to do it yourself. Then when you go on to the larger problem, something like 127 times 63, the idea of how to solve it is the same, but certainly it's not something that you're going to do in your head immediately. You're going to go through the process, you're going to go through the steps. And telling the computer what those steps are is going to be the key to designing your programs great. So again, objects Visual Basic is an object-oriented programming language, and it allows you to quickly create those. So UML is a unified modeling language used in a lot of object-oriented systems. Again, this is an abstraction from any individual programming language. So you would use UML in creating your C++ or your Java programming languages, just as you would use it creating Visual Basic. And again, as a UML is a step back from the programming language to allow you to design your problems. Section 1.7 again is some history of the internet and the World Wide Web. So in the late 60s, the ARPANET was designed, which was the precursor of today's internet. Basically, the idea was that if somebody were to bomb our site that housed all of our important military information, we would be dead in the water. There would be no way to communicate all that information across. So the idea of ARPANET was to design a system that could easily send all of our military information to multiple points at the same time so that no one military base was the key center of information and would create a single point of failure. Again, the information sharing, the way information came across, made way for the internet. There was some precursors to the internet as well, that allowed us to exchange information, but really the internet came out, with the ability to exchange information. So with that comes a set of rules of how we transmit information back and forth. So in order for parties to be able to communicate with each other, they have to be able to talk in the same language. So the protocol that was adopted by ARPANET was TCP or Transmission Control Protocol, which breaks information into packets and segments and allows us to exchange that information across. UDP is out there as well, Uniform Data Packets, to transmit information over the World Wide Web. So really, internets
is a collection of smaller parallel networks. Everybody has their own small piece of their network, and we all bring it together to create a larger network. And again, the protocols that we use are part of what's called the TCP/IP package, and that's what everybody uses to communicate over the internet. As more information is being communicated over the internet, as more things are being available over the internet, businesses are offering online services. You can go on to Target or Walmart or Best Buy, and purchase things. So, generally, there's now competition. Google places ads on almost every page that we see. They track all the information, all the websites we visited to create this analytics. To give us what we want before we know we want it. And as a result, we've had to increase the amount of bandwidth that we had. Again, in the early days of the internet, pages were static. We would bring up one text file of information. So back in the day, we had 9600 baud modems to bring up web pages. That was great. Then we started to want to do more things. We wanted to stream video. Okay, well, if a video plays back at a certain rate, SD video 3.75 megabits per second, HD video 18 megabits per second. It's not really going to work over a 9600 baud modem. You'd have to download that file, and again, downloading would take hours, if not longer. So we increase our bandwidth. We get some cable modems, we get some DSL modems, allow us greater bandwidth. Cable DSL modems now up to like 50 megabits per second. So now, when we click on our video and we start to stream our video, if our video doesn't start playing immediately, we kind of get annoyed with that. Again, customer expectation versus performance expectation. So the World Wide Web, again, is simply called the web, contains all that information, videos, data, text, graphics, and is what most of the websites run on. There's other parts of the web that we won't get into, like the dark web that's only accessible via the Tor network. The Internet too, which is available mainly to educational entities as research using different protocols in our TCP/IP suite. Just be aware that they're out there and that the World Wide Web makes it easier for us to access all this information. So in 1989, CERN, which is Nuclear Research Development in Europe, created hyperlinked text documents, HTML, HTTP, so easier access to tech document to documents on the web, easier access to web pages. In 1994, they have the Worldwide Consortium, which allows us to actually access information, and allows easier access and agreed upon standards to all of the web. Section 1.8 brings us into the early developments of our Visual Basic language. So Visual Basic, again, is a secondary model to our basic programming language. So back in the day of our monochrome monitors and computers, kids used to learn on structured programming language, this language called BASIC, which is beginner's all-purpose symbolic instructional code. Back in the day, they used to make colors dance across the screen and things pop up. And in 1970, Bill Gates created Microsoft, implemented BASIC on their PCs, and then when Microsoft went into their visual graphical user interface or GUI, they brought it with them. So really what Microsoft was trying to do was trying to get other people to write programs in their graphical user interface environment. So nobody would really use Windows if programs weren't written to work within the Windows environment. So there had to be some way to easily create Windows applications and Windows programmings to kind of push their language forward. So Microsoft integrated Visual Basic allowed users to create programs in Visual Basic, and very quickly, Visual Basic took off as a Microsoft programming language. Visual Basic 6 was introduced in 1998, made it faster and easier, but also made it so that they could create larger applications that people could use in businesses very quickly. In 2002, they released the .NET. At this point, most of the functionality of Visual Basic broke down because programs that were written in VB6 wouldn't work in the .NET framework, so you really have two separate programming languages, even though they're under the same name. So just be aware of that if you're Googling around and looking at Visual Basic code. Sometimes you'll run around some code that was written in VB6, and that code's not going to work within the Visual Basic 2012. A lot of the Visual.NET code actually does work in 2012, so you may find some of that as you come across it. And certainly I recommend that you stick mainly to the book. Most of the problems that you're done are going to be contrived from information in the book, so you'll spend a lot of time outside of the book looking for information that you can find very quickly within the book. Visual Basic 2012, again, very popular programming language for programming in a GUI, graphical user interface environment. Requiring a lot less time than other popular high-level languages such as Java, C, C++, C#. Again, Visual Basic is an object-oriented programming language. It has access to the .NET Framework class library. So again, some people have spent a lot of time programming in Visual Basic. All of the programs that they built within Visual Basic have been added to the .NET Framework. So all of those methods, all of those classes are already in that library. So if you're going to create a program, you may want to look at the class library first to see if somebody's already done it. Chances are there's already something within that class library that you can access and don't have to reinvent the wheel. Visual Basic is an event-driven programming language, so you're going to create programs that respond to user-initiated events. So events may be something like a mouse click, a double click, a keystroke, some timer going off. In 2012, it involves touching and finger swipe gestures that are used on smartphones and tablets. Again, when you create a mouse click, what happens is that it sends an event that a mouse was clicked, and it's going to look for something in your program that handles that action. So us as programmers are going to create methods that respond to the events that a user creates. Visual Basic is a visual programming language. So again, you're going to do a lot of programming in our graphical user interface. We're going to have our controls that are buttons and text boxes that you're just going to drag onto the screen. So you don't have to actually map those out. In other programming languages, you have to actually map those out, map their text coordinates on the screen. I'm going to worry about that. Visual Studio is going to do most of that for you. So that's one of the reasons why we've chosen Visual Basic as the introductory programming language in our environment, because it's very easy to create graphical user interface code. So that being said, we can extend Visual Basic onto the internet and into web programming. We're not really going to go into this in depth. Just be aware that it's there. You can program Visual Basic devices to work on Windows smartphones. But again, it's not something we're going to do. Spend a lot of time doing in this class. We're going to spend our attention really on learning the language. So again, here's some background on some other programming language. Again, it's nothing that you'll need to worry about for any tests in this class. Just be aware there's other programming languages out there, and they do various things. Section 1.9 deals with the Microsoft .NET. Again, the .NET interface is to make it easier to program applications that work on the web. The .NET framework contains class libraries to access thousands of built-in programming languages. Programming classes. So you'll notice a lot of programs, when you go to install them, require a certain level of the .NET framework. That's because the programmers of those programs have used something from that .NET library, so it requires that you install that version. Some require that you have older versions, some require that you have newer versions. Generally, the newer versions are backwards compatible to the older versions, so if you have the newest version installed, you don't have to worry about the older versions. Some programmers have chosen to be explicit on what versions you need to have installed, so you may need to install multiple versions of the .NET framework in order to get everything to work correctly. But that's on a case-by-case basis. Section 192 talks about the common runtime libraries. Again, the common language runtime is a virtual machine similar to the Java virtual machine that manages the execution of programs, hides them from the underlying operating system and hardware. So the source code for managed programs are executed and managed are called managed code. So again, for Java, it's a Java binary. For the .NET framework, it's managed code. So again, it's going to hide the implementation between the different processors. I mentioned earlier, AMD and Intel have different compilers. The .NET abstracts that away so that as long as somebody has the .NET framework installed, they can run that wherever they go. Section 110 talks about the Windows operating system. So are certain versions of Windows are required to run certain things. Each version of Windows has their own look and feel. And they usually correspond to some server implementation. So Windows 8 and Windows 10 user interfaces look a lot like Server 2012. Windows 8 and Windows 10 have built within their user interface what's called the Windows Store. The Windows Store sort of works like, dare I say it, the iTunes or Apple Store, where you can put the programs in there and be able to download them directly from the desktop. So the Windows Store has a lot of free applications. You can develop applications and put them in there. This also talks about the DreamStart program, which we have access to as well as full-time students. So you should be aware of that. This talks about smartphones. Again, we're going to skip over apps and smartphones. We're not really going to talk about that. Windows Azure and cloud computing, again, just be aware that instead of running computer programs on local machines and local servers, some businesses choose to run their operations in the cloud. Windows Azure allows you to run desktops built on Windows Framework in the cloud, and people pay for the number of CPU cycles instead of actual physical hardware. Again, we won't dive really into that, just be aware it exists. Section 1.13 brings us to the Visual Studio Integrated Development Environment. So when you go to run your Visual Basic code, you're not going to run Visual Basic 2012 in a software program called Visual Basic 2012. Instead, we have what's called Visual Studio. So Visual Studio is, again, the integrated development environment that's going to run our Visual Basic code. Visual Studio encompasses more programming languages than just Visual Basic. We talked earlier about C Sharp. C Sharp is included within Visual Studio. So Visual Studio is designed to compile many different Microsoft languages. Section 1.4, again, is a test drive of an application. I suggest that you go through this step by step so that you can see what